Hello and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. The last time I spoke with John Leonidakis for a bookshelf conversation, it was to discuss his 2012 project, Not Exactly Cooperstown, a documentary about the baseball reliquary. In this chat, we talked about his latest work, Haino, A Century in the Bleachers, a play on perhaps Arnold Haino's most famous book, A Day in the Bleachers, published in 1951. This time, it wasn't so much about the process of putting a film together, but what one has to do before and afterwards in terms of funding, promoting, and getting the word out. John Leonidakis, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
It's nice to be with you.
So, your latest project is Haino, A Century in the Bleachers, about the eminent sports writer Arnold Haino. And I was just wondering, in this day and age where you're called upon to do so much yourself, if we could talk about the care and feeding of an independent film project.
Sure.
So fundraising has always been a major part of any project, but more and more you see people going to places like Kickstarter or FundMe. And how did you go about fundraising for your latest?
I tried Indiegogo, and it worked out for us. It really only generated a very small percentage of the financing of the film. The rest I financed myself. But it was the first time I had done that, and I deemed it successful. I think we raised over a couple of $1,000s. I was like, hey, that's $2,000 I didn't have to spend out of my own pocket. And plus, we started to create an audience that way. The people who participated in helping to fund the film helped get the word out a little bit. So I saw that as being a very successful endeavor. And, of course, I've been involved with the Wrecking Crew, where that film raised a significant amount of money to pay for the licensing of over 100 of the most popular songs of the 20th century. So I saw where those types of funding resources could be quite helpful.
Now, you did two previous baseball documentaries, Not Exactly Cooperstown and The Day the World Series Stopped. How'd you go about raising funds for that? Those
again, I financed myself. Having been a producer here in Los Angeles for 30 years, I know a lot of the tricks of the trade, guerrilla filmmaking, calling on friends and cashing in favors that I'd had built up over three decades. So, and then, of course, cold, hard cash. But a lot of that was I was cadging my way along. Haino was a little bit different in that I had put together something that required a larger budget. I ended up buying my own equipment to keep costs down. I edited the picture myself up until the very end when I brought in a polish editor. But I'm pretty much a gang of one until we start to go out and shoot, and I bring on my specialists, lighting, camera, and sound people, and art directors, and prop people, and so forth.
So a project like Haino, how long did that take from conception to final editing?
2 years.
And what took up that time?
Well, the first year I was doing it while I was also working on other projects to help pay for this, as well as feed my family and so forth. So that was the big piece. And actually, the first interview I did with Arnold, I didn't even know we were going to make a documentary. I just knew it was important to get him in front of a camera, sit him down, and let him tell his story, which is a remarkable story. I told him, I said, I don't even know what I'm going to do with it. But after the first 3 hours of talking with him, he spun this incredible gold. And I looked at my list of questions, and I said, we haven't even dented the surface. So flash forward about 6 months later, I said, I'd like to come back down. I've got a lot more questions, but at this time I also want to interview your wife. His wife, Bonnie, had been with him for over 60 years, and they were like one person. So I went back and did the interview with Arnold. then Bonnie, and then the two of them together. And by the end of that shoot day, which was another 3 hours of incredible storytelling, I said, well, this is such a remarkable story. This deserves to be a documentary title in its own right. So it really didn't catch on until March of 2014, and then the film, you know, really kicked into high gear after that. And it took until October of 2015 to complete.
Now, part of that process is finding people to interview to talk about Arnold. At what point do you have to decide, I have to stop now, I have to finish this up? Because conceivably you could just find more and more people to talk about, especially someone like him with his lengthy service.
That's absolutely right. Well, the exigencies of the moment, meaning I wanted to get this film done while Arnold was still with us. He was, you know, he was 93 while we were getting ready to finish the thing. So he's on borrowed time as it is. He's got a number of health issues. So it was very important to get him done. And so what we went about doing was identifying who are the key people to talk to about Arnold in his career. And one of the key people we wanted to talk to was Felipe Alou, because Arnold had written a terrific piece with Felipe in November of 1963 of how Latin American ballplayers were being discriminated against and how they needed their own Bill of Rights. And I couldn't get a hold of him. And I said, well, what about Orlando Cepeda? He works for the San Francisco Giants. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's not too far. He said, sure. And I wrote Orlando a letter. I didn't have his email address. I didn't want to go through the Giants. So I just went right to him, and I sent him a letter, and I got a nice phone call back. And we were off and running at that point. But just about everybody I talked with or came in contact with, they said it would be an honor to talk about Arnold. George Vesey of the New York Times, for example. Ultimately, I was able to interview Felipe Alou, who had told Arnold, no writer was more important than Arnold Haino in promoting the cause of Latin American ballplayers in the 1960s. So it's wonderful when you have people who are excited to talk about your subject. And, of course, not all of them ended up making it in the film, unfortunately, but there was no shortage of it all. But because of my background as a producer, and someone who's been very good at being able to manage schedules and stuff, I figured out how to do it all very quickly and very efficiently.
Now, you mentioned it wasn't hard to get people to talk about Arnold. What about getting Arnold to talk about Arnold? Because some people are reluctant to talk about themselves. How is he as a subject?
Arnold is a born storyteller and a world-class raconteur. And so, you know, once he got over the shock of someone wanting to make a documentary about his life, he was initially against it. I said, well, why? He said, well, no one will care. No one will be interested. You'll have about 13 people. You're going to waste all this money and all this time, and no one will care. But I said, well, one of us is going to be wrong, and it isn't going to be me. And because I said, this is a compelling story. You are an American treasure. And we're going to make a film to tell this story and share it with the world, because people love untold stories. And so he was a bit of a doubting Thomas all the way along, and I think that's just part of his nature. He's a hard-bitten, cynical New Yorker. But I think both of us, throughout the entire process, it was a completely transparent process, because they were involved every step of the way. Every time I had a rough cut, I did three rough cuts before I then turned it over to a polish editor. I would sit with Arnold and his wife, Bonnie, who was also very, very bright, and they would give me their comments on every rough cut along the way. And then at a certain point, I said, you know, I've got a world-class writer here. I got to put this guy to work on some of the stuff I'm having a little bit of struggles with. In particular, it was the beginning and the end of the film. And Haino has not lost a step. No way. He still has great chops as a storyteller and someone who can dissect the story and figure out what is needed. So once he was on board, he started to see the rough cuts and an early trailer that we did. I think he relaxed. He felt like, okay, this guy seems like he knows what he's doing. And so he bought in.
Now, you say how sharp Arnold is in his mid-90s. Part part of the beauty of this is talking to some of his contemporaries who have not fared so well health-wise, intellectually over the span of time. Was that a disappointment to you?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a disappointment. My father is in his 90s, and I learned very quickly to do some research on octogenarians and nonagenarians on this project to understand behavior and so forth. And, you know, maladies affect people at that age. Dementia is one thing and so on and so forth. But, you know, Ray Robinson, who just turned 95, still has his marbles and is still very sharp. You know, Al Silverman, less so, but Al was wonderful. He worked very hard to prepare for the interview, and so we got some stuff from Al that we were able to use in the film. And it's wonderful, you know, Al Silverman and Arnold Hano and Ray Robinson, these are three of the sages of sports writing in the golden era of sports in the 1950s and 60s. And they're all still with us, and one of the things I wanted to do was to make people aware of what they had done and their contributions, even though, you know, Ray and Al are not the focus of the film, but they're certainly accomplices in the world of Arnold Hano and his accomplishments.
Now, we've talked about the process of raising money. We've talked a little bit about the process of making the film. What about the aftermath? Because the work doesn't stop when the film is in the can.
Well, that's the whole second part of the job. Just making the film is one thing. The other part is sharing it with the world. And when you're an independent little movie studio like I am, I'm not a big distributor. So I've got to hustle my way around and get this thing shown. So how do we make people aware of it? There are, you know, PR firms out there that will put together press release packages for you. There are, of course, thanks to social media, that was a big clarion call for me to get things out using Facebook, using LinkedIn, and certainly Twitter. Twitter was incredibly powerful and helpful. So many people are on Twitter. Someone said, "Hey, you ought to send a tweet to Ken Burns." And at first I thought it was ridiculous, and then I thought about it for a minute. I said, "Well, man, wait a minute. Why wouldn't he be interested? This is a very interesting subject." And so I sent the tweet to him, and much to my delight, he not only liked it, he retweeted it. And, you know, without social media and Twitter, that doesn't happen. It just doesn't. And then, of course, getting the word out. Many other ways, people that I've from my past films that I've met who work in the news media here in California and Los Angeles and San Francisco Bay Area, and now getting to know some people in the New York area, I exercised those things. But a lot of it was really a byproduct of what I've had to do for 30 years as a freelance filmmaker and producer, which is hustling and you know, utilizing those relationships that you've developed and the new friends that you make, and you know, people giving you an opportunity to tell a story. And obviously newspapers and journalists, they're looking for interesting stories to tell, and this was a very interesting story, not just the story of Arnold and his life, but the story of making this. I mean, it's very Walt Kurtz like from Apocalypse Now. You know, you just dream it up and you go do it. You know, that's the nice thing about working independently. No one is sitting on a rock on a mountain saying, "You're not going to do that. You can't do that. We're not going to let you." And I've been lucky enough to be able to do these things on my own. But if I didn't have my own the skill set and, you know, 3 decades of producing behind me, it would be very difficult.
Now, the goal obviously is to get eyes on your film. So is it more important to you to sell the DVD? Or this is, comparatively speaking, it's a small, very small film. So you're not going to fill movie theaters with audiences to see this. So what about film festivals? How does that play into this?
Well, it's a multi-tiered approach because you have the home video component of selling DVDs. And this is the first time I have offered streaming. I had people come up to me at some of the screenings of the film and said, you know, I'd love to buy a copy of the DVD, but we got rid of our DVD player. All we do is stream now. So once you get it streaming, let us know. So we get that. We have that going. Certainly the film festival piece is very key to getting the word out and getting exposure for the film. That is an enormous subculture in and of itself because it is such a racket. You have to be really careful about which festivals you're submitting to, because there's fees to just to get your film looked at, you know. So there's expense involved there. So you have to be extremely judicious. And I'm proud to say the film has already won its first film festival award. And this weekend, it is appearing at the Irvine International Film Festival here in Southern California. And I've been very impressed with the other titles that are in our category for documentary feature, some of which come from outside of the United States, and they're all very, very strong pieces. And then the other piece is television. I submitted it to PBS because I think it fits the parameters of their American Experience series. It's a perfect fit for that. So those are, and I have had discussions with other distributors about possibly distributing the film. Much like the book publishing industry, there's a lot of niche media out there in the world of documentaries, especially, and so that market is being explored as well. Libraries have been one of the people who are very interested in my titles. And I have a relationship with a distributor that contacted me to distribute my films to libraries. They service something like 30,000 libraries in the United States and Canada.
Now, how do you measure success then?
Number one is executing the concept at a high level. And I think we have achieved that, because unless you have a great story and you execute it very well, you're not going to go anywhere. That's the first step as far as I'm concerned. And the Arnold Hino film has been, you know, certainly the most popular of all the films that I've made in terms of just hard sales of DVDs and interest that we receive in the press. So that's how I measure it, because part of what I'm doing is building an awareness about my studio, my brand, the type of stories that we tell, and we focus on the human side of our national pastime, because there is an endless ocean of stories that have yet to be told from that point of view, and there is an audience for that. So that's what we're pursuing.
Now, do you find that if, let's say, a new audience comes to see Hano and they really enjoy it, does that extrapolate into them going back to look at your past work?
It has happened. One of the nice things that happened with Hano is that a lot of baseball organizations, you know, they've heard that it's a very good film, and so now Sabre, I did a screening for Sabre Los Angeles chapter with Arnold in December. At the end of this month, I'm going to San Francisco Bay Area for the Sabre chapter there. And then in May, I'll be going to Minneapolis to show it to the Sabre folks there. And it's going to also be shown at the 9 Spring Training Baseball Conference in Arizona, which I was already going to be attending. And, you know, but a couple of the folks on the board there saw the film and liked it and said, hey, how about running this? There, to me, those audiences, the Sabre folks, the people who go to the Cooperstown Symposium on Culture and American Baseball, and the 9 conference, that is the sweet spot of the audience. But what I have discovered is so many people who have come to see the film, they'll say, you know, I don't really like sports, I really don't like baseball, but I really like this story. And that, to me, as a storyteller, is what is most important, is that I can hit a broad target audience with a story that resonates with people.
Now, you've been making the rounds with this, and in some cases you've been doing it with Arnold. How has that been, to travel with him, to have him meet the people? He must be enjoying that.
He is, and he and his wife have been happily sort of surprised at the level of interest. It's been, when we do screenings together and we do the Q&A, portions. As I said, he's such a terrific storyteller. When we did our Q&A in San Francisco for the screening up there, you could tell the audience was disappointed that we actually stopped the Q&A. He was getting tired, and we had to stop. But he is just incredibly compelling and a lot of fun. And, you know, people show up with his books, old copies of Sport magazine, and they treat him like a rock star. They want his autograph. They want to talk to him. They treat him like the legend that he is.
Now, how long will you ride this project before moving on to the next one? When do you realize, or when do you get the feeling that it's time that you've wrung this out as much as you can and it's time to move on?
Well, that remains to be seen. I've already started the next project anyway. But, you know, this project is just starting to be known to the outside world. This is the first big film festival that it's in this weekend. I've entered it into maybe 6, 7, 8 other ones, and I won't know if it gets accepted until over the next 2 or 3 months. So the word will be getting out on it. So you kind of don't really know how long the life of the thing is, at least initially, until it plays out. This is a very different film for me because it was largely autobiographical, whereas my others were not. And it has to do with someone who's sort of beloved and legendary. And new audiences are discovering, you know, him as a writer, because not only did he write for publication, he wrote 27 books. He's got some great, great noir novels that were written back in the early 50s that people are discovering. And so who knows how long this will go. I'm happy to be a part of it as long as possible because he's such a remarkable person. And it deserves to be acknowledged.
We've been talking with John Leonidakis, who is the producer of the 2015 documentary Haino, A Century in the Bleachers. In addition, he's produced, or executive produced, Not Exactly Cooperstown and The Day the World Series Stopped. John, thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure, Ron.
And you've been listening to the Bookshelf Conversation with John Leonidakis. Come back again next time when our guest will be Kevin Larkin, author of the very comprehensive Garrig Game by Game. And remember, visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on your favorite topic. If you have a question or a comment or suggestion, please send them to me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks again, everybody. See you next time. Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonderful game."